From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. TNT. This is Jason Q, Citizen and Friends, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Goodness me, what a time it is to be alive. It was the original slogan for this show, and it's returning for 2023 because it seriously is. Doesn't matter what they throw at us, we keep getting better and better and better. TNT Radio has moved to the next level. It's our first birthday, and we should all be enormously proud for the work that we've been able to put out and for, of course, you, our listeners, who have supported us all along and shared the stories and got involved and interacted and now calling in on the live talkback, the open line, which will be open in the next hour when Nicola joins me. And we are going to talk about the royal fallout from Harry's interviews. And there's a lot to talk about in the royal family. And I'll tell you what, Nicola is one expert in that field. And I'm not going to hold back either with my opinions. I never do. Now, how much is too much when the climate people fear carbon dioxide? Check this headline out. Nationwide carbon dioxide shortage could force breweries to close. No, you cannot make this up, can you? But it's true. What's worse than a pub with no beer? How about a country with no beer? Brewers rely on carbon dioxide for carbonating beer, packaging it, and purging fermenters. But with only 7 to 10 days of supply left, Garage Project might be forced to halt operations. This is all coming out of New Zealand. We'll have to shut down production, Garage Project co-founder Joss Ruffle told NewsHub. The cost of carbon dioxide has tripled in the past 6 months, with breweries big and small struggling through ongoing shortages. This is our peak time of the year. It's summer, it's beer drinking weather, and we cannot package beer. It's a disaster. Since the Marsden Point refinery was decommissioned last year, the only domestic production of food-grade CO2 is at the Kapuni Liquid Carbon Dioxide Plant in Taranaki, owned by Todd Energy. However, the plant has been closed for 2 weeks while a safety issue is investigated, and the company can't say when it might reopen. Craft breweries are struggling. It's going to impact wineries, food producers, and anyone who is using CO2 in their process. The gas is widely used in food and drink production, hospitals, and wastewater treatment. Now, in a more serious story, not that having a beer famine is exactly good, but 2.8 million paid out so far by the Vaccine Injury Support Program in Canada, with claimants expressing frustration over how long the agency in charge is taking to process these claims. A program designed to compensate Canadians for vaccine injuries has paid out just 2.8 million since it started accepting claims 19 months ago. According to the VISP website, that's Vaccine Injury Support Program, just 50 of 1,299 claims submitted have so far been approved, with 18 rejected claims under appeal as at December 1, 2022. Claims are approved when a medical review board determines a probable link between a recent Health Canada authorised vaccine and serious and permanent injury. Lake County, British Columbia's Ross Whiteman was one of the first claimants approved by the VISP. The 41-year-old was hospitalised with Guillain-Barré syndrome, a rare and sometimes fatal condition that affects the nervous system, just days after his first and only dose of an AstraZeneca vaccine. I'm told the program that I'm the first for everything related, so I'm the tip of the sword, he says. Now, the report says that more than 96 million doses of COVID vaccine have been administered in Canada. And now I'll interrupt this report for the gaslighting component of it. Here we go. Health experts note the risks associated with contracting COVID-19 far outweigh the risks of vaccination. There have been more than 49,000 deaths associated with COVID-19 in Canada. Of course, 95% of them are in people above working age, but we don't mention that. Claimants are frustrated by the delays. Whiteman said he's received close to the maximum payout possible, which is $284,000 for pain and suffering. That means his claim was approved in May of 2021 and accounts for close to 10% of the total money distributed so far. But the money, he says, won't fix the reality of living with, ready for this, because COVID is worse, no sensation in his hands, feet and lower legs, not to mention the mental burden the vaccine injury has caused both him and his wife. He says 30% of people who get this horrible Guillain-Barré disease end up on life support. life support for taking a jab for a cold. I'm going to require medical attention and expenses for the rest of my life. CBC, that's the reporter, tried to contact the Vaccine Injury Support Program, but of course didn't receive a reply by deadline. My question is, how much compensation for the effects of COVID then? You know that the standard flu symptoms are fevers, chills, headache, and nausea. You certainly wouldn't get $284,000, would you? But then they gaslight us when 99% get this or less. And another person, a 45-year-old Father Julian Schofield, he has to now rely on a wheelchair for mobility after he said he became paralyzed from the waist down days after getting a second dose of Pfizer in July of 2021. He used to be a senior manager at a winery at the time, and expenses for things like adapting his home and vehicle so he can get around continue to add up. We're going in the hole every month. I'm caught here in a wheelchair, constant pain, don't get any sort of relief at all. The money won't fix the reality of living with no sensation in his hands, feet, and lower legs. Another one suffering terribly. It's absolutely disgraceful. And of course, they sit on their hands. If you missed your favorite TNT radio show or interview, simply listen back when you want, wherever you want. Just visit us on the TNT radio website. We're also on all the major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Podbean, iHeart, and TuneIn. There's absolutely no reason to miss out on anything on TNT radio.
What matters to you?
They cover the important story.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Jeremy is back, and the story he's going to lead us in with today is Kirsten Henning, a footballer who refused to participate in the BLM Neil, has won a $100,000 settlement. Tell us more, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jason. Kirsten Henning, a former US football player for Virginia Tech, has been awarded a $100,000 settlement after claiming she was discriminated against for refusing to kneel before a game as part of a social justice demonstration on behalf of Black Lives Matter movement. Henning will receive the sum for agreeing to drop a federal lawsuit against Virginia Tech coach Charles Adair. This was a lawsuit which claimed that her First Amendment right to freedom of speech under the US Constitution was being breached. Under the terms of the settlement, neither Adair nor Henning admit to any wrongdoing, which comes after Henning claims she was dropped from the team after Adair became frustrated over her political views, which included an outright refusal to take part in the so-called social justice demonstrations. In her lawsuit, Henning says she supports social justice and believes that Black Lives Matter, but added that she could not support specifically to the Black Lives Matter organization as she disagreed with many of its core ideologies, including its pursuit of defunding the police. And she added that she was verbally attacked by Adair at halftime during a game in September 2020 after she opted to remain standing while a so-called unity statement was read aloud ahead of the kickoff. Henning also stated that she quit the team shortly afterwards due to Adair's campaign of abuse and retaliation. So I think, Jason, it's welcome that she got a $100,000 settlement, but what if she went the full way, which she didn't, obviously, and argued for the First Amendment rights? That would have been interesting.
Oh, goodness me, wouldn't it just, to tell you what, there's someone we want to get on the show, Kirsten Henning. Talk about having the wherewithal to understand what's going on and not to be intimidated in that process of going along to get along in the teamwork that we're seeing there. This is a really, really terrific story, isn't it? Because someone has decided to literally put their money where their mouth is, gamble their career for all of it, but to stand up for what they believe in, something that's truly lacking in the world today. Anywhere where people are taking a salary, it seems that they go quiet. And here's someone, a real soldier, and saying, not racist, not whatsoever, but not believing in an organisation that many of us know to be corrupt. Well done.
Yeah, I think so, Jason. And I have another story of note. The Satanic Temple of Salem, Boston, Massachusetts, has announced on social media that SatanCon 2023 will take place at the end of April in Boston. It's the largest satanic gathering in history, according to them. And this year's convention will celebrate the temple's 10th anniversary. Participants will have to wear an N95 or KN95 or disposable surgical mask, according to the convention website, and a schedule of events or names of speakers are not yet available. After holding the first ever SatanCon last year in Arizona, the Satanic Temple is moving the event closer to its international headquarters in nearby Salem, known for its witch trials in the late 1600s. The temple claims it has around 2,500 members in the Boston area, and the group claims that its official mission is to encourage benevolence and empathy among all people, reject tyrannical authority, advocate practical common sense and justice, and be directed by the human conscience to undertake noble pursuits. Well, that's what they claim anyway. And they have declared abortion a fundamental religious right and have argued that any state laws restricting the practice are unfairly discriminating against their members.
Goodness me. So they're anti-tyranny, but you must wear an N95 mask to attend. Gutless wonders, the Satanists, and they pretend that they're not really into the devil, but they're all part of this all show and no go nonsense. I think that we could, if we had a red light, if this was TV, this would be when you would play your bullshit-o-meter when you're listening to these clowns in the satanic movement. I deliberately mean to offend anyone who's going out there that is trying to promote this. And if you are pro-Satan, even if you don't believe in Satan, that means you're anti-God in all of it. And that comes at a price. And that price is to be mocked and ridiculed because you're a bunch of lunatics. I don't care who I offend in all of that, Jeremy.
No, I think so. I mean, look, these Satanists, they're very troubling people, I must say.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like it's fashionable to be to be anti, you know, to be it is to be the devil one way or another, to be anti the system and to be antisocial and to be all of this type of stuff. It's just it's a whole lot of nonsense. But good reports today, and I'm really pleased to hear that this young lady, Kirsten Henning, has had a victory with a $100,000 settlement. And as you're right, to be able to take on the First Amendment rights would be something completely amazing. Now, we're going to take a break and come back with the man of the hour. Dan Browdy is going to be with me. He is one of the three authors of the most magnificent paper you're ever going to read. It's called COVID-19 Mass Formation or Mass Atrocity. Dan's been on with one of his partners, David, one who also wrote the article with him. He's back because it's brilliant. I've pasted the article link into the talk, so you can download it and you can read along with it or keep it. It's absolutely brilliant. And before we go to the break, I'm going to quote George Carlin: "The obedient always think of themselves as virtuous rather than cowardly." You're on TNT Radio.
You should hear what Hrvoje Morić is talking about.
Right out of the gates, we've got CBS News national security contributor Mike Morrow, quote, predicting there will be a terrorist attack against the Western interests somewhere in the world in 2023. I guess he's promising us there's going to be a terrorist attack. And I couldn't help but think of my Geopolitics and Empire podcast interview with French intellectual Thierry Meyssan back in April of 2022. And he told me exactly, he predicted this. He said, they, the U.S. Empire, the West, the Pentagon, they will continue false flag attacks against their own allies like they did during the Cold War against the West. So expect a false flag attack this year if you weren't already.
Hrvoje Morić on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Too many people with diabetes don't have regular checks of their feet. What looks like a minor problem to anyone else can then escalate very rapidly to, at worst case, an amputation.
Generally, the signs or the symptoms that someone with diabetes should look for are just changes in their skin, so dry, or they're getting cracks or more calluses.
preventable foot problems can evolve quite rapidly. If they are also in the context of poor blood supply, what you find is that the infection takes hold and rapidly spreads throughout the foot and leg.
Understanding just simple things about how to cut your toenails correctly, the right footwear to wear so that that's not going to cause rubbing, but also so it can support your feet if you've got damage or weakness with muscles and joints. People should be visiting health professionals with regards to their foot care at least yearly.
Go to the doctor, watch your health, and look after your feet.
We can end diabetes-related amputations within a generation.
A cashless society means zero cash. No car boot sales, no markets, no tooth fairy or piggy banks, no saving cash for a rainy day, no buying anything with privacy. Digital currency means every cent you receive will be recorded and every transaction tracked. Lighting the fuse for freedom, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the meat and potatoes segment of this fantastic new format, the new show that's just started this week on, would you believe, today, our first birthday here at TNT Radio. I'm going to introduce you to Daniel Browdy. He has a doctorate in applied psycholinguistics and experience as an imagery analyst. He lectures in areas ranging from communication theory to visual rhetoric. He's a professor of applied linguistics with research interests in symbols, signs, sounds, images, and colors as communication tools deployed by power centers, which aim to shape knowledge and influence human perception and emotion. Selections of his work can be found at ResearchGate. He is an associate researcher with a working group on propaganda and the 9/11 global war on terror. And of course, he's one of the three writers who wrote the brilliant work titled COVID-19 Mass Formation or Mass Atrocity. And like I mentioned before, I've dropped that into the chat if you'd like to have a look at the brilliant article. Daniel, welcome back to Jason Q Citizen and Friends.
Great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, we had you and your partner in truth, David Hughes, on before Christmas, and because the article is just so encompassing of the entire narrative, we were unable, obviously, to get through it all. But for those that missed it, they can obviously go onto our onto the page for the show and download that conversation. But we're going to obviously recap some and extend it a bit more. But before all of that, let's just find out. Christmas and New Year in a world gone crazy, were you able to celebrate it in anything resembling normal from your pre-2019 life?
Great question. Well, I live in Japan, and well, we haven't seen the sort of insanity in Japan that we've observed in the media and various countries throughout the world. Japan has been an interesting case. We've come up against, I wouldn't call it tyranny, but the presence of masks everywhere, even when there had been a lull in cases, people have tended to continue wearing masks. And I think generally speaking, in Asian countries, Asian cultures, masks are they're not something that we see as unusual. So a lot of people have been wearing the masks still, and it's not unusual for us, but Japan has actually maintained quite a bit of reason and logic, which is really nice.
Absolutely. So because the other thing, of course, with Japan was the ability to access ivermectin was one of the few places that you actually could. And of course, that's where ivermectin originally came from, I believe.
That's correct. I think it was 1995. It was invented at a university, might have been University of Tokyo. And the inventor received a Nobel Prize for its invention. So I in fact was able to get some ivermectin in 2021. And it's been quite a blessing to live in Japan during these times.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the other interesting part of Japan is that it has an aging, well, not so much an aging population as much as an elderly population with seems to be a higher life expectancy. And of course, with the price of real estate, you often have multiple people living in homes because it's so expensive. And yet they seem to have done quite well in all of it. This goes against everything that we've been sort of told.
That's right. I think Japan is a really good case study for some of the policies that should not be pursued. Of course, we had local governments here in our region of Japan, I'm sure throughout the entire nation, where you were invited to come and get your jab, but nothing like the sort of tyranny that we have seen in a lot of the Western nations. So it's my good fortune, I guess, to be living in Japan and working here for so many years.
Yeah, it's wonderful that there can be some semblance of sanity in the world outside of the crazy West that is determined to see how quickly it can extinguish or terminate itself in all of this. It just defies the logic. And you cannot even still have a debate in public about any of these issues. It's just all in the too hard basket, which forms part of the work that you've actually done here, because you've explored with your colleagues Matthias Desmet's theory of mass formation, but you've taken it a step further, a very, very important step, because you make the distinction that those making the decisions are not subject to this mass formation, suggesting that they must know more about what's going on. Can you explain how you arrived at the idea of the Desmet didn't make the whole argument there?
I'm sorry, could you recast the question once more?
The idea that Matthias Desmet's theory of mass formation attracted a great deal of attention in 2022. And what you've done in part of this is the review of Desmet's book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism. You and your colleagues argue that it manifests the psychology of atrocity and that mass formation paradoxically serves to legitimize the mass atrocity perpetrated during the COVID era. And in the article, you write, with the declaration of the pandemic that changed the world in March 2020, an army of thought police descended upon populations worldwide. Overnight, the public face of science was transformed from a civil and civilian endeavor into a matter of law and order. In place of what formerly emanated from research communities came edicts from government officials, bolstered by celebrity bureaucrats, enforced by censorship, smearing and coercion, and backed up by riot squads. So in the process, science, as it previously was known, a careful product of time, hypothesis testing, collective critique and pertinent subject matter expertise, gave way to the science, TM, trademark, a kaleidoscopic, ever-changing and capricious set of pseudo-medical justifications for government overreach and violations of citizens' rights, riding on rolling waves of public messaging, manufactured fear in keeping with a totalitarian model. So in setting all of this up, I guess the question, to reframe it, is very early on, the established authority went all in on a hive-minded, one-size-fits-all approach to everything COVID, despite the approaches of lockdowns, mask mandates, social distancing, compulsory experimental meds, untried technology, mass testing. It just goes on and on. And when we read it out, it's psychopathic in all of it. So the mass formation psychosis casting its spell across society's middle managers all the way up to the people who are supposed to lead us, including prime ministers, presidents, medical authorities, some of whom have no sovereign power, but for whom global leaders automatically did what they said, and social media instantly censoring anyone who challenged them. How can all of this be arranged and agreed to without any question across the board? To me, that's the fundamental flaw in the Desmet theory, that he's saying that they fell for it, whereas you can't line all that up to be so perfect. And I think that's where the article for mine, when I'm reading, I'm going, oh, finally someone gets this, because you're pointing to this really, really important shift in the narrative here, that the leaders of the world can't necessarily be caught up in the mass formation psychosis.
It's such a huge and multi-headed beast that I've seen a lot of my colleagues in various disciplines communicate their suspicions as well. So I think one of the ways that you can see the signs of how this has happened is, you know, by looking, for example, at Klaus Schwab's own words. Of course, him among many others, but we'll take Klaus Schwab as an example. And I'm not really sure if he was boasting or, you know, just being frank, but what seems clear enough is that these centers of power he's been organizing and nurturing since the early 70s, I believe it was 71 or 72, really illustrate how the apex predator class plays the long game. They sabotage governments. And at least, I think, those that maintain the pretense of respecting democratic principles. You know, like, what do we, when we think of a democratic government, we think of like due process and the rule of law. And all of these features of modern governments, we're being told either explicitly or implicitly that they have to go. We have to prepare ourselves for a new normal, since they interrupt the flow of business and the rule of its leaders. So when you look at the, you've got the, the Forum for the Young Global Leaders, you've got the Global Shaper Program, right? So these sort of draw on young talent across the world to set the agenda of the future. Which is meant, of course, to reproduce the power structures that have already driven the world to its present late stage. You know, like it's absolutely necessary to integrate the youth into the business. That's key to its successful reproduction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my colleagues have pointed to a Hitler youth organization of the 30s and 40s. Now, interestingly, you might recall this, the pride expressed by Schwab for the young generation when he was on a panel at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, you know, his exuberance for figures such as Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. And you might recall that, thinking, you know, and if you think of the ironies on stage at the Kennedy School of Government and the world's key figure and working to weaken the governments of sovereign nations in the interest of this great global reset. So he pointed out that, you know, we penetrate the cabinets of governments. And he tells, I think it was David Gergen, that he's proud to know that half of this cabinet are actually young leaders of the world, part of this Young Global Leaders program. He cited Argentina and France. So I think this is how you're able to see the necessary uniformity of thought and practice in so many nations around the world. And you've also got articles citing how the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have pretty much bought off major news outlets in many nations. The Columbia School of Journalism, for example, has been writing about this, surprisingly. I think it was 2020 or 2021, they wrote a piece on how influence, fear, and favor are now managed by the new model for corporate media. I'd also add that the approach to remaking the world, to, you know, quote unquote, building back better or built back better, it actually makes perfect sense for those at the top, since technology in the hands of the masses is really like a kind of like a double-edged sword. You know, the new tools, they threaten to upset the social, economic, and banking order that has held sway since at least the Industrial Revolution challenged the power of monarchies around the world. There's an interesting quote by James O'Connor, an expert in finance, I think it was from the early 1970s, he talked about the state and how the state must involve itself in capital accumulation. And it does this by mystifying its own policies and calling them something they're not, or trying to conceal them so as to maintain legitimacy as a political entity. That's quite interesting.
That is really interesting. Hold that thought, Dan. We're just going to go to news headlines, or we'll run into the next break. We'll take them right now and continue the conversation straight away. You're on TNT Radio.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Show them how it's done.
Let's go.
I got news for you.
News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Tsunami alerts were issued for parts of Indonesia early Tuesday following a powerful earthquake which jolted residents from their beds in Australia. Hawaii's Kilauea volcano, one of the world's most active, has started erupting once again, less than a month after it and its largest neighbour, Mauna Loa, stopped spewing lava. And a container ship that ran aground in the Suez Canal on Monday morning has been refloated, avoiding any major delays.
Did you know there are many ways you can listen to TNT Radio? Why not stream us direct from our website on your desktop, tablet, or mobile device? Or download our app from the App Store? We even stream live on YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey. We've got you covered on TNT Radio.
Welcome back. We're talking with Daniel Browdy, professor, about his article that he's co-written with two of his colleagues, COVID-19 Mass Formation or Mass Atrocity. And at the moment, what we're doing is we're dissecting this theory of mass formation, and we're leading it to be a much bigger story behind the scenes. And Dan, just before the break, you mentioned the quote of James O'Connor, a quote that came back from the 70s, that the state must involve itself in capital accumulation, and it does so by mystifying its own policies. This seems to be part of the great deception or projection, and part of this very same psychosis. Can you elaborate a bit more on this on this whole idea?
Well, probably the best source would be to refer to Bernays. Bernays had written about this even previously, at length, about mystification and the engineering of consent. I think you cited Bernays before, but he was fascinated by his famous uncle's theories about human desire and behavior. You know, he wanted to apply them to the propagation of concepts and products and to make them more palatable for consumers. Not just concepts and products, but that sort of research and psychoanalytics, it could also be used in the propagation of policy. So for those who are unfamiliar with Bernays, you can see in the book, the managers of modern societies that claim to abide by the sensibilities of classical democracy, to be under the sway of, I think he says something like, men we have never heard of, who govern, who mold the public mind, form our tastes, and suggest ideas. So Bernays pointed out that it's really the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the habits and opinions of the masses that is really the logical way in which our democratic society is organized. And if you happen to say this without quoting Bernays or any of the other related research, you get called a conspiracy theorist. But it's interesting that a lot of this stuff, the ways in which consent is engineered in publics, has been really at work. It's fast 100 years. And it's clear that so much of our habits and our perceptions, our behaviors, what we like, what we dislike, all of this has been a part of the manufacturing process that we are subjected to, exposed to, when we engage with the dominant forms of media.
Wow. It is something else, because this is where I keep coming back to this exact moment, and I talk about it as a split in the species. There are some that can see it, and there are most that don't, and there have been many other academics that try and put a percentage on that and apply the old 80-20 rule to much of this. It's such a compelling argument all along. I want to go back to the article now and just extend a little bit in this direction, where you write that the thesis holds, this is the Desmet thesis, holds that under societal conditions of free-floating anxiety, loneliness, meaninglessness, and discontent, populations are ripe to believe stories that offer an object for their fear and anxiety. With a shared purpose in a state of hypnotic fixation, populations fall into formation en masse on a mission to annihilate the object of their collective angst. The masses believe in the story not because it's accurate, but because it creates a new social bond. In this way, the masses come to accept even the most absurd ideas as true, or at least to act as if they were true. And that's a big point, that second point, because this is the denial of vaccine injury at this point that's quite unbelievable. My question is, why is society so desperate to create a social bond, even if it is based on a lie, if they can work that out? And can it be only as a result of long-term social conditioning or total exhaustion with a slave work till you die system?
That's a great question.
Thank you.
I don't know that we're necessarily keen to create social bonds with liars. I think most people find liars revolting. It's just that we live in a system ruled by liars. And to me, it's so plainly obvious when you behold the injustices everywhere, the rank inequities, the systems of coercion and deception, and the techniques now used to force the masses into serfdom and slavery. And, you know, while those who rule, while they own the means of production and the means of capital production, they also own the means of information production. They have within their power this ability, therefore, to shape knowledge, to define and redefine and name key terms and concepts, and are thus able to shape our knowledge and perception. So we perceive that we must live in a system such as this because, you know, we're saturated by the messages that beckon us to obey the influencers who are in power and authority, to not question, you know, to simply go along, to get along. You know, human beings are naturally social creatures. So it's only natural that we form social bonds, right? Families, communities, nations, et cetera, to protect one another. But there's some really interesting research in linguistics and cognitive science that attempts to explain this question about social relations and language. Would you like me to
elaborate absolutely.
Just a bit?
Please.
Okay, well, so it comes from the idea that words have power. And the kind of power that we don't ordinarily perceive or reflect on critically. So if you think about it, some words, you know, we can't even say these days. So humans, we have language and therefore consciousness, while other creatures have communication systems. And these are fundamentally different because in mammals, communication systems tend to be linked to the limbic system, which activates muscle response. So humans have this additional quality of cognitive processing we call consciousness, whereby, you know, we can kind of like go offline if we choose and then reflect critically on words or calls. And the behavior can be found in our tendency to screen calls. You know, we can like wonder if we should respond to them or not when we get a call. Or like, take for example, if we're in a crowded movie theater and somebody yells, you know, fire, and then we can like wonder, you know, we don't smell smoke, so is somebody pulling our leg? Is somebody playing a joke on us? And so we can go offline. But in the wild, the call of a warning such as that would immediately trigger reflex. So when those in positions of power and authority can when they can like maintain the optimum levels of fear and paranoia in the population through the dominant messaging system, you know, which is TV, you know, all of the mass forms of communication, they are effectively bypassing or short-circuiting our inclinations toward reflection and critical thinking. So a reactive population over time, it's less likely to engage in these forms of thinking and therefore, you know, less likely to arrive collectively at alternative ways of imagining how the world should be. And of course, this dispels destruction of the natural scientific inquiry we have long known, which is constantly asking questions and thinking critically. This is the thought we're conditioned to believe about, you know, the science, quote unquote.
Mm. Now, there might be an interruption there in the call. We'll go to a break, Dan, and we'll come back and make sure that line is fixed. You're listening to TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Don't be misled. The Freedom Caucus isn't 20 or even 21 members. It's 45. The 20 and then 21? Yeah, they were a slight flex. Bargaining chips to show that the conservatives could be conciliatory, to make meaningless concessions and flip their vote to Kevin McCarthy. The plan all along was for the six to vote present, lower the bar to 216, and get Kevin in after he'd made all the concessions. And what concessions, you say? Well, how about three members on the all-important Rules Committee? That's veto power. No bill can now reach the House floor without Freedom Caucus approval. And Mike Rogers, who lunged at Matt Gaetz, he's stepping down from the House Steering Committee. Granted, he's going to chair the Armed Forces Committee, but again, the Rules Committee will be able to block any legerdemain he tries. And Eyepatch McCain, oh, sorry, Crenshaw, you're not going to be chairing the Homeland Security Committee. That's gone to Freedom Caucus member Mark Green. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
George Soros has supported the election of numerous left-wing DA candidates. Since 2016, when Soros first began to back the campaigns of district attorneys, Capital Research Center researchers have tracked more than $29 million in funding from Soros through political action committees, PACs, formed specifically to back left-wing DA candidates. In total, Soros's cash has generously supported over 20 individual candidates, many of whom won their elections and remain in office. They include Diana Becton, Contra Costa County, California. Becton was one of the first in the position to have no prior experience as a prosecutor. During Becton's first years in office, four Contra Costa cities made the list of the top 100 most dangerous cities in California in 2018, and both violent crime and property crime increased in 2019. Soros has spent a combined $6 million on California DA races, much of it wasted on failed candidates. But almost half was spent on the successful campaign of George Gascon from Los Angeles DA. Since the election, Gascon's implementation of left-wing policies led to a crime wave with soaring homicide rates and increased shoplifting sprees. Kim Fox, Cook County, Chicago, Illinois, who's known for her 2019 decision to drop charges against Jussie Smollett for his infamous hate crime hoax, has made headlines for presiding over Chicago's largest spike in homicides in more than 30 years, while her office dropped charges against 30% of felony defendants during 2020.
Support childhood slavery and buy an electric vehicle. We mandate that the truth be told.
Lighting the fuse for freedom.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the show. And for those listening, know that we're talking with Professor Daniel Browdy out of Japan on an article that he's co-written with his colleagues, COVID-19 Mass Formation or Mass Atrocity. And we're exploring the idea of how this can actually go on, the psychosis that comes across the population. And I'm going to go back to the article here where it is written that the injection of over 5.5 billion people as of November of 2022 with substances now known to contain a devil's brew of undisclosed ingredients constitutes a clear violation of the Nuremberg Code and a global crime against humanity. And that's a quote from author David Hughes himself, and asks the question, what kind of psychology is needed to commit such a crime? I would continue that by saying, in fact, many people are okay with not knowing what is in the concoction and are happy to trust and accept the consequences because it is authority smothering them with the solution. And so I asked the question, would you agree that this single event or attempt is what may be called sleight of hand, the ultimate devil's trick played upon humanity, because virtually no one even bothered to notice, let alone ask the very questions that David is asking, including just asking what's in this damn thing.
That's right. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I've got you.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think sleight of hand is actually quite brilliant. But it's actually part of a whole range of official forms of deception.
Mm.
And we've written about this before, how a technocratic tyranny can hide in plain sight in what we call a medical mask, how the military-industrial media complex uses communications to kind of like blur the line or erase the line between organic life and what's now being called synthetic biology, as it's known in the scientific literature. So you might recall the 2014 leak to The Intercept of a pretty interesting presentation that was given by the Joint Threat Research Intelligence Group, in which they lay out techniques in concocting deceptions, perceptual illusions to nudge targets' behaviors in certain directions, using decoys to dazzle the eyes of the masses, and deploying the principles of scams and magic tricks. Using dissimulation to hide the real and simulation to show the false.
Wow.
When we pay close attention to the dominant forms of media, we can begin to see the divide between organic life and synthetic quickly disappearing. It seems like we are confronting the global effort to robotize humans. Yes. and humanize robots. And that seems to be a part of science fiction, but it's actually in the scientific literature, the peer-reviewed scientific literature that goes back at least two decades. It's pretty clear that there's an effort to connect humans to the, I think what Marshall McLuhan referred to in the 1960s as the global central nervous system. And we're seeing that now in some of the technical terms that refer to intracorporeal networks, how the networks are coming together in bodies through self-assembling nanomaterials. All of this sounds extremely ridiculous. It sounds absurd to talk about this in polite conversation, but it's actually something that has lots of funding. Governments around the world are funding all of this research and development of new forms of life, which are not natural, which are not biological, but which are synthetic. So I think the question is, I think one of the questions that we should ask ourselves now is, how did these materials get into our bodies? How do they get into the corpus? You know, many people are wonder nowadays, as they access their Bluetooth devices, whether they too haven't been turned into communications devices.
Mm.
There's a lot of research going on in Australia, New Zealand, in Spain, in Italy, in Korea. A lot of researchers are looking into this, and they want to know, you know, what is in these platforms that is making human beings appear to be connecting to the global central nervous system, as it were. And the literature for decades, at least the past two decades, shows their development. But how did they manage to migrate from concept to laboratory to human bloodstreams? And did anyone, an authority figure, you know, to alert us to these new networks? Then the public messaging is really everywhere, that we need to recharge these injectable platforms. This is why we are constantly being told, you know, get those boosters.
Yes.
It's quite easy, I think, if you dare to look, to see the world really in transition today from, you know, transformers, transplantations of organs, transnationalisms, transgenderism, transathletics, mm-hmm. transient communities, the transmission of disease, you know. I think one of the questions is, have we been played over the past 3 years as being transhuman? Did somebody yes. not alert all the human beings that we are in fact now being transitioned from human to transhuman? I think that's an yes. important question to ask.
It's absolutely, I think it's the biggest question of all, because I've been arguing for some time now that I believe that the trans agenda, this 30-year period to move to marriage equality and then a 30-second leap into transgenderism and the acceptance of it. For mine, I think it was the stepping stone to get the human being, to the collective human, to accept sentient rights for AIs, which is what you just said earlier, which was the humanization of robots versus the robotization of humans. And I think that was the merge there, because if we can accept that, no questions asked, then there's no reason why we wouldn't accept the rights to humans. And then we basically turn into Westworld, the TV series, the movie at that point. And I believe that's what's headed here. And it would only be in about one generation where the old robotized human would, by definition, would be redundant at that point, because when you think of it, if you create a robot, a sentient AI robot that's got a chip for a brain in its head, if that robot wears out after 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, you take the chip out and you put the sentient AI with awareness into a brand new, up-to-date, modernized robot, and this thing's got eternal life. So it seems to me that that we've superseded ourselves at this point, or we play to make ourselves live eternally, which seems to be impossible at this point. But we are replacing ourselves, and we can't even have the discussion, as you just mentioned, the idea of going from concept to lab to human bloodstream, and nobody alerted us, Dan. It's truly, it is the worst of any horror movie you could ever imagine at this point.
Yeah, and the fact that it's happening right under our noses.
Mm.
Yeah, I think we probably got some pretty clear signals of this in 2017 at the World Government Forum. I think it was in Dubai when the AI Sophia was trotted out onto stage and was given to great fanfare. Saudi citizenship. So this, some people have written articles about this momentous event in history when a machine is given citizenship. I mean, volumes of books can be written about be written about this, but
it's, you know, truly astonishing. Indeed, we are. Dan, does it feel like that the work that you're doing, and I don't want to sort of load you up or anything, but for mine, I feel like that you must be one of the most preeminent researchers with the ability and the clout to be able to put all this together and deliver this information out to the world. It just seems that there's more people that are on the other side of the fence trying to activate all of this stuff and there's nobody in academia or in media, apart from you and me talking about it right now, that's actually right up on the cutting edge of all of it. We've only got a minute left, so you've only got about a 20-second response in all of it. But how do you feel about that comment?
I don't think I'm really the only one. There are many researchers now whom I'm in contact with who are now coming out of the woodwork, and they're very much keen to speak up. So I think the future in terms of our collective consciousness, our awareness, explicit awareness of what's happening is it looks pretty good to me.
Oh, well, sorry to cut you off there. We have run out of time, but that's a wonderful encouragement to know that, because we've covered a lot of ground today and obviously gone into different directions. Now, that was Daniel Browdy. His article I've put into the comments there on the chat on Unlimited Hangout. It's truly amazing. We're going to have to take a break and commence the next hour after the news. You're on TNT Radio.